Welcome back to Backbone Radio. This is Joshua Sharp sitting in this evening at KNUS 710 AM and KZNT 1460 down in the Springs. We're joined this half hour by Colorado resident James Bennett. He is, if not the inventor of, then the popularizer of the term Anglosphere. He's got two books out already. One is The Third Anglosphere Century, The English-Speaking World in an Era of Transition. Prior to that, he came out with The Anglosphere Challenge and currently has in the works and soon to be published another book, America 3.0, with Michael Lotus, who blogs under the name Lexington Green at one of my favorite economics blogs, Chicago Boys. Really a terrific blog. If you're not going there, you should. He will join us right now to talk about the relationship of the British and the European Union and how the European Union's travails may provide some opportunities for the UK and for the Anglosphere in general to retake some leadership positions. Mr. Bennett, welcome.
Thank you, Joshua. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. So the British have always sort of been, you know, one toe in, one foot out with the EU all the way back to the 50s and the days that it was the common market. They didn't join the common market initially, and they've always sort of never really graduated from that section, that sense that the English Channel really does provide a separation. How has that played itself out most recently in the EU's financial travails and the political changes that they want to make, that the EU is trying to make, and that the British maybe are not so keen on?
Well, I think that the key story is that starting in the early 90s, the Europeans made a push towards much deeper integration. There has been, right from the beginning with the European unification idea, the idea of turning Europe into a federal state, or as some people think, a unitary state, a United States of Europe, with a very centralized economy and a strong protectionist barrier against the rest of the world. And particularly the French, after the Suez fiasco in 1956, the lesson they took from that was that they could never trust the United States again, and that Europe would have to be built into a third competing world power against the U.S. and the Soviet Union, and ultimately triangulate between the U.S. and the Soviet Union to regain some real measure of independence. And that's been one of the strains of thought in European unification ever since then. However, this had very few fans in Britain, so the advocates of United Europe in Britain took the line that this was merely going to be a common market, was going to be a free trade area and a bargaining tool to get better tariff rates with other foreign powers, etc. And it was pretty much sold to the British public on that basis. And I would also add that it only became a major focus of the British government with Harold Wilson in the 60s, after negotiations he had been carrying on with Lyndon Johnson and, at that time, Canadian Prime Minister Lester Pearson, to create a North American free trade area between Britain, the United States, and Canada. And
oh, what could have been.
Johnson had that on his agenda and approved it. There was a huge amount of staff work done. I talked to people who had been on that staff on Harold Wilson's civil service back in those days, and it was really close to ready to execute, and Johnson completely lost focus on it because of the Vietnam War and the response to it, and of course, it was just dead and buried. Nixon tended to favor European unification because he thought it would make Europe a stronger bulwark against the Soviet Union. So it has been limping along as one thing in some people's eyes and another thing in another other people's eyes. And actually it was part of the price for the French acquiescence to German reunification in 1990 that they also strengthened the institutions of the European Union so that the French felt, well, this way we can keep some kind of check against the rising German power, because they were very much afraid when Germany went to 80 million people after the merger, that it would just totally dominate Europe. Mm-hmm. Now, that's kind of happened anyway. But they made the commitment to a single European currency. They made the commitment to a much stronger unified fiscal administration. And at that point, although John Major was a conservative, or conservative in name only, prime minister in Britain, was for this, a good portion of his party was really against it, and they rebelled and against the Maastricht Treaty, which was going to implement all this stuff, so they've been known as the Maastricht Rebels.
Right, I remember that, and a number of, starting with, I want to say it was Denmark, who voted against the Maastricht Treaty, and any of these changes require unanimous consent.
Yes, and there were several referenda. Basically, every time they held a referenda in any European nation, they always voted against it, and then they did the great European tactic of saying, well, you have to keep voting over again until you get it right, i.e. until you vote the way we want you to. And but the Maastricht rebels in Britain accomplished one thing, which was to force Major to negotiate an opt-out. In other words, give Britain the right to remain in the European Union without having to join the single currency. Denmark got one as well, and this turned out to be very interesting because although Tony Blair took office promising to take Britain into the euro and very enthusiastic about further European integration, his chancellor, his finance minister, Gordon Brown, was against this primarily because it meant that he would no longer be able to go to the G7 meetings as an independent representative for Britain.
We can't thank Gordon Brown for much, but I guess we can count it. We can thank him for a labor minority and keeping the EU out of keeping the sterling.
Yeah, so it's a case of making the right decision for mostly the wrong reasons, but in the long run of history, I'll take that. That's all that's on offer. So, so it was actually kind of hanging by a thread. It was really the fact that Gordon Brown got to set the, what they call the conditions. They said when the British economy is right and when the development of the euro is right, then we'll go in. And somehow he had these tests of when this would happen. Somehow the test never got met, so it just dragged on and on, and then, of course, after the last couple of years, everybody in Britain realized that they had dodged a close one.
Right.
The idea of Britain going into the euro is, deader than the parrot in the Monty Python sketch,
but there's
for a few fanatics who still believe it might happen. But and now the question is, this new round of financial regulation that the European Union is trying to impose, something like 85% of the real financial activity in the European Union occurs in London. And basically, if you let the majority, qualified majority vote in Europe control this, it's the ultimate letting the mice bell the cat. The British financial industry is the cat, and the rest of Europe are the mice putting the bell around its neck. And it got to the point, basically, where Cameron is a very soft Eurosceptic, if you can use that word at all. He made some Eurosceptic noises, but my thought was that that was mostly just politicking to try to keep his right happy and to stay in power, because David Davis, who was his main rival for the leadership, had been quite a vocal Eurosceptic.
We've only got about a minute left before the break. I wanted to jump in, if we could, to what happened most recently, where Britain essentially established some conditions for their continued participation.
Yes, and this was because of this threat of financial regulation, which Cameron has mostly given in on, but the Sarkozy-Merkel alliance was trying to impose even stronger conditions. And simplifying rapidly here, but Cameron went to the Brussels summit, and mostly because there had been another very sharp rebellion from his Eurosceptic right in Parliament a couple of weeks before, felt that he couldn't just stand up and say yes to this. So he basically just kind of failed to give his assent. It's been called a veto, although it wasn't actually a veto because there wasn't a formal treaty on the table. But that was enough to, I think, cause a sea change in the mentality of people in Britain. I was in the UK in January and talked to quite a few people, and it was just